Ezra, Dave, and Drew return on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Trying to get hold of Mike Harrington of the Buffalo News to join us to discuss the moves the Sabres made. Of course, a reminder, you can listen to the Leafs and the Capitals. That game six goes tomorrow night. It's available here on TSN 1290. This segment of the program is brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich. Located in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com.
On a day like today, it's blizzardy outside. It's a good day to go for a little bowl of borscht.
I definitely would be a good day for some borscht. Stay nice and warm, something like that.
Yep.
Before I forget, go any further, I have to, of course, wish my lovely wife, Laura, a happy anniversary. It's our fifth year anniversary today.
Fifth wedding anniversary or fifth year of being together?
No, we've been together for 10 years. It's my fifth wedding anniversary.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why when you said five, I was thinking that. Have you been married for 5 years?
I've been married for 5 years.
Wow.
Can you believe anybody would spend 5 years married to me and 10 years with me?
Well, we're technically married to you of sorts, and it's hard enough for us for 3 hours a week.
Yeah.
And for Ezzy for 5 hours a week.
Yeah, exactly. And that, I mean, definitely.
So Laura deserves big kudos is what I'm saying.
It's 100%. Big kudos and
big
whatever.
Ups to Laura.
Yeah, big ups to Laura for staying married to me for, you know, going on 5 years. Struggling to get a hold of Mike Harrington. We'll keep at it. Rory's doing a great job behind the board and trying to get a hold of Mike. Let's look at, why don't we talk about Patrick Laine?
Who?
Named a finalist for the Calder Trophy earlier this week alongside Zach Werenski.
Yeah. And it's unfortunate that Werenski couldn't finish the series against the Penguins.
Well, after his face exploded.
Yeah.
I mean,
good on him just for coming back in that game.
Yeah, and then his face swelled shut.
Yep.
Which was it was a pretty gruesome injury.
He had a great year.
He had a tremendous year, and he deserves more credit than he's actually going to get because for the entirety of the season, it was all about Laine and Matthews. There's, you know, a campaign on social media, for lack of a better word, that's cherry picking certain stats that, you know, would make it seem like Patrick Laine is more deserving of the Calder Trophy than Austin Matthews. And, I mean, we're obviously here in Winnipeg. We're a Winnipeg-based radio station. We know just how good Patrick Laine was this year for the Jets. And had he not been injured and had he not missed games, maybe it's a different story. But given everything we've seen of the two seasons of Laine's year and of Matthews' year, of the fact that Matthews was the best player on a playoff-bound Toronto Maple Leafs team, I just, you know, I understand bias is a very strong emotion. There's just no way you can give Patrick Laine the Calder Trophy over Austin Matthews.
Well, of course there is, Drew. I mean, I probably would vote for Austin Matthews, and I know people will be shocked by that, but I mean, Patrick Laine had an excellent regular season. He had a better goals per game average and a better points per game average than Austin Matthews, but he missed those 8 games with the concussion, and then he missed the 1 game at the end of the season with the flu. But I mean, look, Austin Matthews scores 40 goals. He gets more points than any other rookie. So, yes, I agree that I think Austin Matthews is going to win it. But there's been this kind of Winnipeg versus Toronto battle going on amongst fans and media all year. And, you know, if you vote for Patrick Laine and you're from Winnipeg, you're biased. If you vote for Austin Matthews and you're from Toronto, you're biased, right? But the reality is this is one of the best rookie races we've seen probably since Sidney Crosby and Alex Ovechkin back in 2005. So you're talking about guys like William Nylander. You're talking about guys like Mitch Marner. You're talking about Matthew Tkachuk. Matt Murray doesn't even get to be a finalist this year. He was still a rookie this year, right? Even though he won the Stanley Cup last year, Drew. So, I mean, this was one of the best years in recent memory. A guy like Sebastian Aho doesn't even get talked about a lot. He had a phenomenal rookie year for the Carolina Hurricanes, right? So for me, I don't really care who wins the Calder Trophy. I really don't. For me, it was just exciting to watch the rookie race this year. But yeah, if we're talking about who's going to ultimately win it, and you talk about this Toronto bias and everything like that, let's be honest. Austin Matthews had the best rookie year. He got his team into the playoffs. He plays one of the toughest positions at center. So if he does ultimately end up winning, Dave, he deserves it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head, though, as when you talked about this being the best rookie class in recent memory that I can think of. Like, every player, I mean, Mitch Marner is the guy who's not even being talked about right now, and how integral was Mitch Marner's play to the success of Austin Matthews?
It's a great player.
And the one thing that people seem to want to give Matthews credit for that I've, you know, they say, well, he's playing with rookies. But he's playing with phenomenal rookies. He's playing with guys who have an extreme amount of talent. He's not necessarily being forced to bring guys up to hit play to his level. Mitch Marner has played exceedingly well with Austin Matthews, and I would give Mitchell Marner a lot of credit for the good play of Austin Matthews. So a lot of people want to say that because you're playing with rookies and you know, they want to say, well, Liney plays with these guys. Sure, okay, he's played with more established players. I'm not saying otherwise, but you're not exactly putting scrubs with Austin Matthews, and he's playing well in spite of them.
I don't think Laine should be penalized for playing with more established NHLers, and I'm not sure that Matthews should be awarded or rewarded for playing with younger players, to your point, Dave, because those younger players certainly have talent themselves. I can't take a step back, look at both of their seasons. And, you know, maybe in January when Line A had a goal scoring lead, you can make that argument. And probably back then, you know, Line A may have been the Calder Trophy favorite. But at the end of the regular season, and that's when voting happens, with all due respect to our fans here in Winnipeg, I just don't know how you could say that Line A is more deserving than Matthews, right, given the entirety of their seasons.
Right, and I mean, when you look at the Norris Trophy, the finalists were announced yesterday. Victor Hedman mm-hmm. was nominated for the first time, but you've had Eric Carlson, who's won it twice, and Brent Burns, who's been a finalist before but never won it. It's most likely going to come down to Burns and Carlson splitting the vote, right? I don't think, even though Victor Hedman had a great finish to the year, 70 points, yeah. most likely it's going to be Burns or Carlson. And it's the same thing, Drew.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, I don't really care who ends up winning the Norris Trophy, right? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, those were the three finalists. Like, they are obviously going to name a winner, but it doesn't really matter to me. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need this, you know, a ribbon or a trophy to tell me, you know, who is the best defenseman, these absolute awards, right? And, you know, it's a similar case with the Calder Trophy. I mean, Dave just mentioned it. Mitch Marner and William Nylander finished tied for third in scoring. They're not even finalists, right? You could argue that, you know, it should have been three Leafs as finalists for the Calder Trophy. And I know, you know, Winnipeg fans aren't going to want to hear that. And again, I'm not saying that because I think Patrick Laine was second to Austin Matthews as far as the best rookie. But again, you look at his points per game and you look at his goals per game, and I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I mean, I don't think the chasm between Austin Matthews and Patrick Laine is as big as people think. I mean, Matthews is going to win it. Don't get me wrong. But Line A also...
Deservingly so. Yeah. It's not something that we're Winnipeggers should take up torches and say we're outraged because Matthews is going to win it over Line A.
I think what it ultimately comes down to is those nine games that Patrick Line A missed. I think he'll be hampered by that. I think that if he plays those nine games and he scores at the rate... And let's be realistic. It's not just the nine games. I mean, he came back from that concussion and he wasn't exactly 100% right away, mm-hmm. even when he was back in action. So... The truth is that if Patrick Laine doesn't suffer that concussion
sure.
in Buffalo, then the reality is I think that he probably, if he kept in scoring on that current pace, probably would have ended up winning the Calder, would be my guess.
I agree.
And I would have had no problems with him winning. But based on the fact that you've got Matthews getting his team into the playoffs, you've got him finishing with more points, and I know it's points per game, blah, 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 but you know he's playing center. It is a tougher position than wing. You know, again, I'm not saying it's there's. I don't know which one of you two used the word chasm. I don't think there's any giant.
That was my word.
Sorry, that would be Ezzy.
I think that's the first time I've used that word.
I'm not sure you know what it means.
that's fine. But the point is,
that's not funny, Drew.
I don't know that there's a big gap.
I don't know what it means
between. That's why I simplified it into gap.
Yeah.
But the truth is, I don't know that there's a big space in terms of what the final vote. I'll be curious to know what the final vote will end up looking like. But I'm just saying, like, my suspicion is it's going to be close because the truth is there isn't a tremendous amount separating these two players. And again, I think if you have Laine finish out his season, then my guess is he probably wins it. But you can't project players. This isn't what the player's projection could have looked like. It's what did they end up with.
By the way, the definition of chasm is a deep fissure in the earth, rock, or another surface, a profound difference between people, viewpoints, and feelings.
Now here's the question, Ezzy. What's a fissure?
That's some type of material. Rock?
Well, it's usually a hole in the rock.
And it's not spelled F-I-S-H-E-R either.
What?
It's not spelled
like Carrie Fisher. Like,
no, it's spelled F-I-S-S-U-R-E.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's different kinds of Fisher. It's you know,
Fisher.
Fisher.
Not Fisher.
I know. I understand. I know.
Is this a spelling contest?
I'm aware of how it works. In any event, getting back to the subject matter at hand, which wasn't the definition.
I'm more excited for the pitchforks that are going to come out after Drew for his besmirching of Patrick Laine.
I just don't understand how. I mean, like I said at the start, bias is a very strong emotion. But with all due respect to, and it's a matter of opinion, and sure, there's no right or wrong answer on it, but I don't know how an objective observer can sit back and say that Laine deserves it over Matthews, given the body of the work that they produced over the regular season. One team, one guy.
And that's why Matthews is probably going to win it, but I don't think it's as
I don't think it's a Matt. He's going.
They're not as far apart in their
seasons.
It's
not going to be unanimous. I mean,
guy had 40 goals, the other guy had 36 goals. Come on.
Exactly. It's a wonderful situation to be in. You know, in fact, you could make the argument it's probably a better situation to be in that there's no pressure necessarily on Patrick Laine to replicate and to match the Calder Trophy winning season of a year ago.
I think you've been drinking too much of Gary Lawless's Kool-Aid. That's what's happening.
How's that?
Well, because he had some leftover Kool-Aid on the desk, and I saw you drinking it.
Okay, fair enough. We're not sure what happened to Mike Harrington. We'll try and get him on over the next 75 minutes. We'll come back. We'll talk about the playoffs. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com.
Live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Pleased to welcome back to the program our good friend David Alter. David is covering the Leafs and the Capitals series for TheAthletic.com in Toronto. David, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure, David. Last night, a fantastic Game 5 between the Capitals and the Leafs. And Justin Williams, you know, all he does is score overtime winners more often in Game 7. But last night, the Caps get a much-needed Game 5 victory as they head back to Toronto with that 3-2 series lead. They were perilously close to being down and facing an elimination game in their opponent's building if the Leafs are able to pull it off in overtime last night.
Yeah, and you know what? What was interesting about that is right after that game, Leafs head coach Mike Babcock was rather confident in his feeling that this was close enough that we're likely going to see a seventh and deciding game in this series. And I mean, when you look at it, look, four of the five games have gone to overtime. All five have been decided by a goal. I think on aggregate, all the shots on goal are exactly the same. And on aggregate, the goals scored have been different by one goal. So, I mean, there's every reason to believe that this game could have gone the other way, as you mentioned. And for that reason, I think you had the very confident Mike Babcock saying that, well, this is a lot of fun, and they fully expected to be back at Verizon Center in Washington on Tuesday for a seventh game.
David, do you continue to be amazed at how the line of William Nylander, Austin Matthews, and Zach Hyman rises to the occasion?
100%, and I think the one thing that was really apparent with that line, at least for the first couple of games, from a possession standpoint, yeah, they were kind of pushing the play when they were on there against that secondary line that the Capitals have. But more importantly, they're scoring now, and where space is at a premium, it's amazing the kind of stuff that someone like William Nylander can kind of still go east west carrying the puck with the zone. Without much trouble and still set up the plays like he did to Austin Matthews, who now has goals in three consecutive games. I think that's a huge part of why Babcock is feeling confident. I mean, you have the Kadri line that has been an effective shutdown line for them. The fourth line's been pretty good in those fourth line matchups during this series. And then you've got the Matthews line clicking and getting more and more minutes and playing like the first line that we fully expected them to be from the beginning of the season to what they will probably be for years to come. So I mean, yeah, you have to like what you see from Toronto's perspective there, and all the indications are such that that line's only going to continue to improve in that series.
You know, David, I don't think anybody was anticipating a sweep, but not many people were projecting Toronto to do as well as they've done. Do you think that they caught the Capitals off guard with how hard they've played in this series?
I think there's a little bit of that. I mean, look, the Capitals, if anything, probably learned last season not to get too high on any sort of expectation when it comes to playoff opponents. I mean, they won the President's Cup trophy last year. They get eliminated in the second round. They've been haunted by playoff issues throughout their entire franchise history. And I mean, the coach, Barry Trotz, has never left the second round as well. It's one of those things where, you know, maybe they're not surprised that Toronto was going to have a little bit of a pushback, but they certainly did learn early on that Toronto isn't that last place team in terms of the quality of opponent that maybe you would expect from a President's Trophy winning team in terms of matchups. So I think there is something to that. I think probably one of the biggest surprises really has been that Toronto's been able to push the play as well as they have and not really show any sort of nerve that a young team would typically have in their first playoff experience. I think that's probably been the most surprising element of Toronto's opposition to what Washington was expecting.
David Alter, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. David's covering the Capitals and the Leafs series for TheAthletic.com. Game 6 goes back in Toronto tomorrow night, a game you can, of course, hear live on TSN 1290. David, sort of a two-part question. Your thoughts, first of all, on the Nazem Kadri hit on Alex Ovechkin last night in the first period. And then secondly, a comment about Kadri's play thus far in the series. 2 points in 5 games, but I think the points don't tell the full story about his impact on the series.
Oh, no, they definitely don't. And, yeah, to the second part of that, I think Kadri and his entire line, particularly Kadri, has been impressive in shutting down the Ovechkin line in the series. I think we all expected the Oshie, Backstrom, who am I forgetting there? I'm sorry, it's so early in the morning.
Oshie, Backstrom, and Ovechkin to a large part.
Yeah. Well, that whole top unit. I mean, they've been getting it done on special teams, which Washington has had the edge, but not really 5-on-5, and the Kadri line's been the number one reason for that. But I think that's been a huge reason why this series has been hugely close for Toronto. And I think as for the hit goes, it's tough. I mean, in real time, it looks really bad. When you slow it down, it's hard to really show that Kadri was really going for the lower part and trying to hurt the guy. So I can kind of see it. It's what they call one of those low bridge hits. The rules on clipping in the NHL rulebook are not clearly defined. And I think what this has done is opened up the conversation to kind of, you know, at least maybe make some rule that should say that is deliberately illegal. But because, you know, it's one of those things where it's up to interpretation. What if a guy's coming at you and you duck last minute to avoid the guy's head and you get him that way? So then you're kind of putting someone in no man's land and it becomes a hockey hit. It doesn't look good. I don't think he did it intentionally. I'd be shocked if there was any sort of fine or suspension to come out of it. I don't think that would happen. But at least there was good news for Ovechkin that he was able to come back. I don't particularly think that Kadri was deliberately trying to hurt Ovechkin in that situation. I just think it looks really bad in real time.
David, how would you assess Jake Gardiner's play in the series? He played more than any other defenseman on the Leafs, including Morgan Rielly, who I thought has been really good in this series. He's got 4 points in 5 games. But Jake Gardner's a guy that's been criticized a lot for his defensive play. Nothing to do with his offensive play. He can definitely move the puck and contribute for the Leafs. But Jake Gardner, what have you thought about him in the first 5 games of this series?
I think Jake's been really good. I mean, this is a real proving ground for him. 4 years ago, he was one of the key defensemen in that playoff run against the Boston Bruins and kind of improved as the series went along. And now, outside of game 5, I believe he was leading all the other games in terms of minutes. And it looked like him along with Zaitsev after game two became the go-to pair for Babcock in terms of shutting down that line I was trying to say before, and really get that help in terms of neutralizing that opposition. But at the same time, he's been doing a great job of controlling the puck. The problem with Gardner in terms of the eye test is that his style of play is a lot of high risk, high reward. He's getting more of the reward, but then when there's mistakes, you kind of look at, oh, well, he probably should have done this. And that happened in game two before the Leafs ended up winning that game when the tying goal happened late. I think a lot of people felt, oh, I mean, he could have dumped the puck there. That would have avoided a Washington goal instead of just carrying the puck back. And that's what you get with Jake Gardner. You get, like, a lot of good there. There's some bad that comes with it, too. But over the course of the series, it looks like he's honed a little bit of the bad stuff out and brought more of the good stuff into his game. And I think that's why you're seeing the crazy amount of minutes that he's played in this series.
David, the Leafs had the number two power play in the regular season, but they're middle of the pack during the playoffs. I saw you tweet yesterday that their power play in this series has been a complete 180. What is it that's changed in your mind from the regular season into the playoffs?
You know, it's really tough to say. The biggest difference, especially in that game in Game 5, is their zone entries have been terrible. And if I actually take a stopwatch to all four power plays, I haven't done it yet. I probably will do it later this afternoon. But I would wager that the time out of the zone was in the majority as opposed to the time in the zone. And that's pretty damning when you start every power play in the offensive zone. But they were really bad. They only had four shots on goal in those four power play opportunities. Washington's power play has just been a lot more effective. It's been above 30%. The Leafs have been at around 17%, which in the playoffs is not good at all. And there really has been no formula as to why that's happening. Washington has been the better team in that regard. And if those things were even, I think we're looking at the Leafs leading the series or perhaps winning the series already, because they had all these opportunities. You look back on it, you have four of them, especially when the whistles are not supposed to be often. You're not supposed to get as many power play opportunities. Toronto's had plenty of them, and they've been unable to capitalize, going 3 of 17. It's been really bizarre. It comes down to just a systemic thing of just getting things back on track. And I think Washington's also done a pretty good job of taking away the middle of the ice. The Leafs like to keep that one man up high and try to set up for the jackpot shot through the middle. And the Caps, EK, and defense, for a large part of it, have been doing a pretty good job of limiting the lanes and disrupting any sort of pass that comes across the middle. I think that's number one.
David, we'll let you go on this last question. Mitch Marner, his ice time has dropped dramatically throughout the course of the series. Mike Babcock, unhappy with Mitch Marner's play as of late?
I don't think he's unhappy with Mitch Marner's play. I think he actually, yesterday, when asking him about the Matthews line, he broke down all four lines and he said that he would like the Bozak line that Marner plays on to step it up a little bit more. I think Marner did a really good job of kind of carrying the pace of that line throughout the course of the regular season. But for some reason, that line doesn't have the jump. And maybe that is Marner, because he really was a big standout portion of that line in terms of the speed that they create. But if Marner's not going at all cylinders, it really makes the whole line look pretty slow compared to the other ones. And it is a cause for concern, because that line is supposed to be, I guess, now your third line. It was the second line for much of the season. It's being relegated back, and there's been times now where Babcock's been more comfortable throwing out that fourth line that Boyle centers, just because they're getting it done on the offensive side of the ice more than the Bozak line is. Marner's got to step it up. I don't think he's disappointed in it, though, but he's really not getting any help from his line mates, that's for sure.
David Alter is covering the Leafs and the Capitals. He covers the Leafs for TheAthletic.com.
Dave, no more 6 a.m. flights.
Oh, goodness. Hey, we're trying to keep the cost low here. Sometimes those are the best flights to take out. It's not my fault that they keep taking multiple overtimes going into it.
Do you think you're going? Do you think you're going back to Washington, or do you think the Caps are able to close it out in Toronto on Sunday night?
I think we're going back. I mean, certainly the team feels like they're going back. They're spreading all the right positive vibes about that, but the series has been too close that there's every suggestion that the series should go. The only thing stopping them is if they really just don't show up. If they let the moment come out from over them and don't play to the way they've been playing and buckle under the pressure, that's the only way we're not having a Game 7, really.
Well, Game 6 ought to be quite entertaining. The entire series has been, in our estimation, the best of an entertaining first round. It goes tomorrow night in Toronto, a game you can hear live on TSN 1290. David Alter from TheAthletic.com in Toronto. David, appreciate it. Thanks for doing this.
Appreciate it, guys. Thank you.
We'll do it again soon. Take care. Let's head to break. When we come back, the Oilers and the Sharks, they play Game 6 tonight back in the Bay Area. We'll talk about that one next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're on the Curve on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Team, the Edmonton Oilers down 3-1. They claw and scratch to get it to overtime, and they have been relentless throughout this overtime period.
Hour number three of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show starts with the San Jose Sharks Edmonton Oilers series. The Oilers leading that series by a 3-2 margin after a Game 5 overtime victory earlier on Thursday night. Oscar Klefbom ties the game with 2 minutes and 46 seconds to go in overtime, and then David Desharnais ends it with a minute 45 to go in overtime. I think actually Klefbom tied it in the third period.
I didn't want to correct
Sorry.
You, but yes.
Yeah, it occurred to me as I was saying it in my head. Klefbom tied it with 2:46 to go in the third period. Desharnais wins it with a minute 45 to go in overtime, giving the Oilers a 3-2 series lead. Bounce back game for the Oilers after they were demolished in Game 4 by a 7-0 margin. And Game 6 goes tonight in San Jose with the Sharks desperate to send it back to Edmonton for a Game 7. That would be Monday night.
That was just another one of those games where it felt to me like that Montreal-New York series where I was watching this team that had a lead. They're playing with the lead. Now, they had a 2-goal lead in that it was 3-1. But they felt content to really not push the play after they had built San Jose.
The Sharks.
Yeah, San Jose had built a 3-1 lead, and it really didn't feel to me that they were going to push the play. They looked like they were content to just sit on those two goals. And as Don Cherry loves to say, the 2-goal lead in hockey is never one that's easy to protect. Mm-hmm. And Edmonton chipped away at it. You know, Letestu got him the 3-2 goal. And then that third period was like Edmonton. And it just felt like it was a matter of time. And Klefbom released a huge bomb from the point. Like, that was like an unbelievable laser beam.
That was like the hockey equivalent of a Happy Gilmore drive where he was able to run up to the puck. I mean, he took a running start of that slap shot from about 20 feet behind it. He got all of that shot.
Well, and credit goes to eventual OT winner David Desharnais, who had a beautiful setup on that play, used his speed, drew a lot of the Sharks to him with the puck, set it up, and honestly, Klefbom had nobody around him and really just had time and space to just unleash that shot, which of course tied the game late in that third period. But yeah, I just think San Jose made a critical error, especially for a veteran team. It's somewhat surprising, but they really just sat back and they just allowed Edmonton to dictate the pace and allow them to get back in the game.
And this series has been a teeter-totter, right? You had the Sharks winning Game 1 in overtime, and you had Games 2 and 3, which were low-scoring, completely shut out. Cam Talbot, back-to-back shutouts, right?
2, 3, and 4 all featured shutouts.
Right, but more so, you know, just the high-scoring game because San Jose scores 7 goals in Game 4, and then you had 7 goals in Game 5, right? So for me, what's been most impressive about what the Oilers have done is that Connor McDavid, for the most part, has been shut down by the de-pairing of Mark-Edward Vlasic and Justin Braun. He's only got 1 goal in 5 games. Not to say that he hasn't had an impact on the game, because Connor McDavid is always going to have an impact on the game, but you've actually seen, Drew, Todd McClellan put Drake Caggiula up on the top line with Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl. Fajula was a guy who's played on the third and fourth line for most of the season. Should mention he also played for UND and was a standout at UND. But that's what's been the most impressive. One night it's Zach Cassian who's the hero, Dave, and then the next night it's David Desharnais. David Desharnais was traded for Brandon Davidson prior to the NHL trade deadline, and good for a guy like David Desharnais, right, on the fourth line.
Had a bad year, a terrible year in Montreal.
Well, yeah, and I mean, he's towards the end of his career, but that's what happens in the playoffs. Heroes emerge, right? And David Desharnais also had an assist in that game, so, I mean, he was definitely the hero of Game 5. Zach Cassian was the hero earlier in the series in Games 2 and 3, right? So, I mean, give the Oilers a lot of credit. That is what we've talked about. The biggest difference between the Oilers this year as compared to last year is not just a healthy Connor McDavid. It's about those free agent and trade acquisitions that they've made, right? So you're talking about Milan Lucic. You're talking about Patrick Maroon. You're talking about Zach Cassian. You're talking about David Desharnais, Chris Russell. I mean, this is a much deeper team than many, including myself, were giving them credit for. And now you're starting to see the depth guys are the guys that are getting the winning goals.
Well, if you had said at the beginning of the series that through five games, Zach Cassian and Oscar Klefbom are going to lead the Oilers in goals scored, they each have two goals, you would have said the series would probably be over at this point in time.
I would agree with that. And Klefbom and Larson have been really good. I was critical of that trade. But the reality is Adam Larson has formed a formidable pair with Oscar Klefbom, right? And Andre Sequeira and Chris Russell have also looked good out there. And even a guy like Matt Benning, a rookie who many didn't expect to play full-time for the Oilers, has been really good on that third pair. So, I mean, give the Oilers a lot of credit, right? They've been resilient, and they responded well, Dave, to that 7-0 drubbing, right? Because, as we know, I mean, when the series is tied 2-2, it can go anyway. And your chances of winning the series are much better, around 80%, 78%, when you win Game 5, right? So you're going to go back to San Jose now, and we know that San Jose plays really well in front of their home crowd, but, you know, Edmonton overcomes, you know, that lead. They come back from being down 2-1. Patrick Marleau scored a huge goal there in the second period for the Sharks, but the Oilers respond. They get that late goal in the third, as you mentioned, Drew from Klefbom, and then David Desharnais gets the winner. And, you know, the mark of a good team is always that you're going to get goals from not just one or two lines. You're going to get them from anywhere in the lineup, and the Oilers are getting that.
You know, the other thing I thought that merits mention is the play of Mark Edward Vlasic and how good he's played against Connor McDavid. And it's interesting because they've focused on the broadcast a lot of times where you'll see Vlasic chasing McDavid to prevent him from getting time and space. So it was like you see this defenseman who should be in the Shark zone. He's actually in the Oilers zone because he's with McDavid trying to prevent him to really getting that space to kind of get his legs going to set up to really kind of penetrate the Sharks zone and establish an Edmonton presence. So Vlasic's played McDavid really well.
And you know who's loving this series going long more than anybody else, Drew? The Anaheim Ducks.
Sure. Well, Ducks are just sitting at home waiting. They hope this series goes seven and then multiple overtimes in the last couple of games here.
Cam Fowler's getting healthier. We don't know if he's going to start the second round. He most likely won't.
But Sammy Vatanen's getting
healthy. Sammy Vatanen's injured. Yeah. And, you know, that series against Calgary was a physical series. Those are two physical teams. They were the two most penalized teams in the NHL during the regular season. So the Anaheim Ducks right now are loving the fact that this series is going long. They're definitely going to be hoping for a game seven.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. You know, it really has been an interesting series. Besides the seven-goal outburst, the San Jose Sharks have had a lot of difficulty, you know, scoring goals. They get shut out in games two and three. I would say that Cam Talbot has certainly had a very impressive first experience as a rookie goaltender in the playoffs.
Yeah, with the exception of game four when he was pulled.
Well, yeah, okay, so they had one bad game, and you sort of got the impression that game was coming. But you knew that
the San Jose Sharks had to respond. If they go down 3-1, series is over. See you later, right?
The Sharks are a veteran team. They're not going to just roll over. They were the winners of the Western Conference last year for a reason. And Martin Jones was fantastic. He's been very good in the entire series. He was fantastic in that overtime period in Game 5. I mean, the Oilers could have won that game multiple times earlier in the overtime, and Jones stood on his head just to get it late in overtime before Desharnais was able to finish it. Game 6 goes tonight. I have trouble seeing the Oilers going into San Jose to beat them tonight. I just don't think that the Sharks would lose on home ice. I think this is going back 7 to Edmonton on Monday night.
I think it's going to be another close game, and I wouldn't be surprised if either team wins this game. I don't know if either team has an advantage, but yeah, sure. I mean, you obviously have the home ice advantage, right, Drew? But, you know, earlier in the series, you know, it looked like the San Jose Sharks might lose this series in five games, and, you know, they've come alive. Joe Thornton, obviously, missing the first two games, coming back in game three, but he wasn't a much of a factor in game three. It was game four where he finally came alive, and we talked about it. That was really going to be one of the keys to the series, right? How big of an impact were players coming off of injuries, Logan Couture and Joe Thornton? And Logan Couture, again, I thought he took two or three games to really get going in the series. He's been good in the last couple of games, right? And, you know, it is really going to come down to, in my opinion, who wins the series. If Connor McDavid does get going offensively, I mean, he's the best player on either team, and he's been held to one goal and 3 points in five games. And for a guy who scored 100 points this year, I mean, that's shutting him down. And we talked about it. We expected Connor McDavid to not necessarily score two goals every single game. Mark-Edward Vlasic and Justin Braun, arguably a top three D pairing in the league, right? So, I mean, if Connor McDavid gets going tonight, again, but, you know, it's probably going to come down to, Drew, one power play or one save, right? Most of the games in the playoffs, it's unbelievable. We talked about it. Maybe two or three of the eight series have been one-sided. I mean, if you want to throw in Pittsburgh and Columbus in there, that series was closer than I think some people are giving the Blue Jackets credit for. But certainly when you're talking about Toronto, Washington, or Ottawa, Boston, or some of these other series, they've been all one-goal games for the most part.
When we come back, the Nashville Predators have advanced to round two. They swept the Western Conference winning Chicago Blackhawks, winning in terms of the regular season, a result that nobody expected. We talk about that series. We talk about where the Blackhawks go from here. That's up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
On the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Games, and to see the way this crowd, this building responds to it, simply remarkable.
Our good buddy Willie Donick with the call for the Nashville Predators on their TV broadcast. Raise your hand if you had the Predators defeating the Chicago Blackhawks in four games and sweeping that series and sending what was a lot of people's favorites to win the Stanley Cup home, not with the Blackhawks going out with a whimper in the first round for a second consecutive season. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew Mandel, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you here in studio. That is a... I know it's an era of parity in the NHL, and nothing's ever too surprising, and any team can beat any other team on any given Sunday, as the expression goes. They can also do it Monday through Saturday as well. But that, to me, was a jaw-dropping result, that the Blackhawks go out that quickly and that easily in four games to the Nashville Predators.
Well, the Chicago Blackhawks scored three goals in the series.
That's not good.
Three goals in four games.
Advanced stats. The advanced analytics tell me that's not good.
And one of those goals was in the third period, late by Jonathan Toews, right?
When they were already down, what, 3-1? It was
3-0. Yeah. So I agree with you, Drew. I'm not shocked that they won the series. I picked Chicago to win. I think it was in seven. It was in six or seven. But
Ezzy, you had Chicago to win in six.
Yes. So I'm not surprised that they won the series. It's the manner in which they won the series. Completely shutting down the Chicago Blackhawks offense. And Pekka Rinne quite simply outplayed Corey Crawford. Mm-hmm. And, you know, heading into this series, I mean, Corey Crawford's got the Stanley Cups, and Pekka Rinne is an older goaltender, but
Crawford with a .902 save percentage in the series, Rinne with a .976 save percentage.
Just think about that for a second. Yeah. 976.
Yeah, it's incredible.
That might be one of the best save percentages we've ever seen in a series, honestly. I mean, going back to previous series, I mean, Dominik Hasek, you know, put up some good numbers, but 9-7-6
different
in
altogether.
Four games. And, you know, the line of Ryan Johansson, Philip Forsberg, and Victor Arvidsson was one of the best lines in the Western Conference all year, and they quite simply outplayed the Chicago Blackhawks' top lines. And Chicago doesn't necessarily rely on a top line as much as Nashville, right? Because you've got Patrick Kane and Jonathan Toews separated on those two lines, right? But Kane, Anisimov, and Panarin were a non-factor. And Kane, Anisimov, and Panarin were also one of the top offensive lines all year, right? Mm-hmm. So Chicago's offense, guys, just completely dried up in the series. But again, give the Nashville Predators credit. I mean, give that group of defensemen featuring P.K. Subban, Roman Josi, Ryan Ellis, Matthias Ekholm, Matt Irwin, and Yannick Weber, give them a lot of credit. I mean, they played really well. Peter Laviolette had these guys playing their system to a T. And Chicago just wasn't able to get anything going offensively. And, you know, it is definitely going to go down as one of the biggest upsets of all time. But let's be honest, guys, this Nashville Predators team has been on the cusp for a very long time. It's been the third year that they've played the Blackhawks in the first round. The first two went to Chicago, but those first two series, the Predators took a lot of those games to overtime, right? We were talking about it with Adam Vingan a couple weeks back. Mm-hmm. You know, they have been a team that is just waiting to bust out. Dave, I know, picked them to go to the Stanley Cup Finals. So it's not like this Predators team. I mean, if anything, Drew, the reason why the Predators weren't picked was because they were the eighth seed and they kind of stumbled a little bit at parts in the regular season. But they were pretty good down the stretch. And, you know, again, this is a team top to bottom, pretty darn good. And, you know, they were missing Colin Wilson and they were missing Callie Yarncroke in the series. And, you know, these guys came through. Guys like Kevin Fiala, mm-hmm. they came through in the clutch. So
overtime winner for Fiala.
Give them a lot of credit.
Dave, do you think the Predators the Blackhawks underestimated the Predators?
I don't know how you could. Well, I guess I could see how you could in the mid to early part of the season, because remember, a lot of people, I wasn't the only one, who picked Nashville as a team to kind of come out of the West. And I think that when they stumbled out of the gate a little bit, people were somewhat thrown off and they thought, okay, well, maybe we've kind of overestimated what this Nashville team has kind of as a sum or a collective team. And then they kind of seemed to put it together towards the end. They obviously made it into the playoffs over teams like the Jets and the Kings. And, you know, there was a lot of thought as to whether they would even finish in the playoff in the top eight. They did. And I mean, I don't know. I guess you probably may have underestimated them, but it was obviously at your own peril because this is a Nashville team. And honestly, that game four was impressive. I mean, the first period, there's no scoring. Second period, you know, Nashville gets things started. And it wasn't like they just got it started and then they just kind of sat back. Like, they kept the pressure on that entire game. And then, so Josi gets the first one. And then in the third period, when you think you've got a one-goal lead, are you going to nurse that? You know, they make it a three-goal lead. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, Jonathan Toews doesn't score till late in the game on a power play. A meaningless goal. And then Victor Arvidsson comes through and gives them a 4-1 lead. And yeah. At that point, of
into
course.
Into the empty net at that point.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, the point is, you still had to, like.
The party was on.
The party was on, right? And yeah. Nashville was celebrating, and with good reason. I thought that they played an excellent series. Pekka Rinne was phenomenal. I mean, like, it was unbelievable how good he played. And the truth is, as attested already, a lot of their guys that they needed to step up, stepped up big.
Dave, I should mention, Callie Yarncroke actually did play in the series. He was injured before the playoffs. Colin Wilson didn't play mm-hmm. in the series at all. But for the most part, I mean, when you're talking about the Blackhawks, a lot of people are going to be talking about this being a tired team, an older team, a team that's played a lot of hockey, a team that might be on the decline. As far as I'm concerned, they're not on the decline. I mean, the Predators just caught them at the wrong time and played so well and just stifled them offensively. I mean, when you're talking about Patrick Kane, Jonathan Toews, Panarin, I mean, these guys, it's not like these guys are towards the end of their careers. I mean, Marian Hossa might be towards the end of his career. I wouldn't be surprised if he plays two or three more years, Drew, but they just got outplayed and outworked, simply.
Here's Stan Bowman. It was locker room cleanout day and exit interview day in Chicago this morning. Here's Stan Bowman from earlier this morning. I'm completely, completely disappointed. Stan Bowman, of course, being the Blackhawks general manager. It's unacceptable to be where we are today. I'm frustrated. I'm angry. This was a tough, tough loss for us all to take. Standing here April 22nd is not the way we expected our season to end. And it's a complete failure when you measure it against the expectations that we have of ourselves. We did not come even close to reaching the standard we have set over the years here. And that's unacceptable. Any successes that we did experience this year are completely overshadowed by the abrupt ending to our season. It's not close to good enough for anybody. I think it's time right now to take a look in the mirror and face facts. And when you do that, you look at accountability, and that starts with me. I need to be better. There's no doubt about it. I'm going to take a look at all things. I can promise you I will be better. Top to bottom, we need more. This is unacceptable to be where we are today. There will be change moving forward. Change comes in many different ways. So the specifics of how we're going to change things into next year are not really meant for this forum. But I can promise you we need to be better. What can the Blackhawks change given their salary cap situation?
Yeah, it's a good point. And you had five rookies playing in this series, Drew. And, you know, guys like Ryan Hartman and Nick Schmaltz and Tanner Kiro, Vinny Hinostroza. I mean, these guys didn't do anything offensively. But again, it goes back.
The superstars didn't do anything either.
It goes back to, exactly, Jonathan Toews and Patrick Kane had a combined 2 goals in 4 games, right? But you're talking about Artem Anisimov, who did nothing in the series. Marian Hossa had no points in the series. So you're right. The veterans, the guys that are not the secondary scorers, the guys that play on the top two lines, didn't get it done offensively. But for me, that's probably the biggest difference between this Hawks team and the teams that were winning the cups for 2 out of those 3 years, right? Mm-hmm. It was the depth. So you're missing guys like Andrew Shaw. You're missing guys like Brian Bickle. I think they've lost their identity a little bit. I mean, this team can still score goals, and it's still a good defensive team. I mean, Corey Crawford had a great year. And as far as I'm concerned, I mean, it wasn't defense that was the problem. It's not like Nashville was winning every game 6-2, right? Chicago wasn't scoring any goals.
Pekka Rinne had as many points. He had 2 assists. He has many points as the top scorers for the Chicago Blackhawks.
He doesn't get enough credit, you know, as an aside for the way he can handle the puck.
Yeah, he really
does.
Not
many goalies handle the puck like that. And Pekka Rinne has always kind of been that third defenseman for the Nashville Predators, right, Drew? But, I mean, if anything, I mean, maybe they should have gone out and acquired someone at the trade deadline like they did last year with Andrew Ladd, right? Not that that worked out because Chicago lost to St. Louis in the first round, Drew. But, I mean, maybe he relied a little bit too much on rookies. But, I mean, those rookies were good. Guys like Schmaltz and Hartman actually had pretty good rookie years, right? So, I mean, again, I think they just got beat by a better team in that series. I'm not saying necessarily that on paper Nashville's not a better team, but look, at Nashville can score goals. They've got a great group of defensemen. Pekka Rinne is a great goalie, and they're a good possession team. And people don't give them enough credit. I mean, towards the last couple of months of the season, if you look at adjusted team Corsi, Nashville was one of the best teams, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I mean, I don't think you're in a rebuild situation. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if next year Chicago is in first or second in the Central. They still have Patrick Kane and Jonathan Toews and all these other great players that were there when they won the Stanley Cups. It's the supporting cast. And, you know, maybe you look at the defense and you say, you know, Duncan Keith and Brent Seabrook, Nicholas Jalmerson, they're not getting any younger. Mm-hmm. Maybe you want to go out and you want to, you know, acquire someone to make that top four better. But as far as I was concerned, Brian Campbell was pretty good in the series.
Yeah, and Campbell is going to take some time to decide whether or not he's going to return, play another season in the NHL. You know, it's a problem. I mean, I don't think it's certainly not a time to hit the panic button or anything in Chicago because they still have Patrick Kane and you still have some tremendous players. The question becomes, do your young players, not that they deserve the blame for this, but at some point in time, you need sort of that secondary scoring to come up and take a little bit of the pressure off your superstars when your superstars can get shut down. Because the Predators have one of the best defenses in the entire NHL, and they were able to neutralize the impact of Kane and Panarin, and I mean Marian Hossa at the end of a, you know, at the end of an 82 game season isn't as, I mean, Marian Hossa is what, 38 years old now? He's going to look his age at the end of the year after 82 games, and so younger teams are able to, and younger defenders are able to have a greater impact at the end of the season.
Well, that's
on
why
him.
I think you have to start looking at Marian Hossa. Even though Marian Hossa had a pretty good regular season, I mean, you have to look at him almost as a situation like Brad Richards when the Chicago Blackhawks won their last cup. I mean, they had him up on the top line at times. They had him on the third line at times. At this point in his career, I don't think he is. Again, I mean, he's a future Hall of Famer, but I mean, you're right. I mean, it's a Jaromir Jagr situation in Florida last year, right? Jaromir Jagr, he slowed down in the playoffs. He wasn't very effective for Florida. It's one of the reasons why they didn't get past the first round, right? He was their leading scorer, but just wasn't that effective in the playoffs. So I don't think, again, that, you know, this is a situation where the Chicago Blackhawks should be panicking, but when you're a team that wins the Stanley Cup almost every year.
Yeah.
I mean, when you get knocked out in the first round, I mean, maybe you're panicking a little bit, but I still think this team is going to be a contender for many years to come.
Here's Mark Lazarus from Thursday's Chicago Sun-Times. He, of course, covers the Blackhawks, good friend of this program. But all hope is not lost with regard to the Blackhawks. The Hawks might not be the dominant team they once were, but they're in no danger of tumbling out of playoff contention. And most important, another great team can be built around the remaining pieces of the Hawks' golden age. The championship window doesn't have to close. It just might need to be propped open for a season or two until the next generation is ready to bust it wide open. And I think that's a good summation of where the Blackhawks really are. They're almost like Team Canada in the 06 Olympics. They're great players, might not be as great as they once were, and their youngest players, the next wave of great players, just weren't ready this year to take that next step forward to do what it takes to be a Stanley Cup champion. And full kudos to the Nashville Predators for their performance. Right now, the Predators look like they're Stanley Cup worthy, and it's going to be a fascinating remainder of the playoffs for them, because I would expect them to get past either the Blues or the Wild in the second round.
They finally slayed Goliath, Drew. They could never get past Chicago in the first round, and they finally did it.
It'll be fascinating to see what happens next. When we come back, we shift our focus a little bit. We head over to Regina to talk about the Western Hockey League playoffs. The Regina Pats are going to do battle with the Lethbridge Hurricanes. We're going to be joined by Phil Andrews, the Regina Pats play-by-play broadcaster. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
On the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour, you're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Ezra Ginsberg, Dave Minuke with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome to the program Phil Andrews. Phil is the Regina Pats play-by-play broadcaster. The Pats and the Lethbridge Hurricanes are in the midst of the Western Hockey League Eastern Conference Finals. Game one went last night in Regina, a game won by the Hurricanes. Phil, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Start with last night's game one. You know, this was the Pats had a tremendous year in the Western Hockey League, and the Hurricanes come in and they steal game one. They steal home ice advantage. What was your assessment of last night's contest between the Pats and the Hurricanes?
Yeah, you know, going in, you know, two really good teams. I mean, you mentioned the success that Regina had during the regular season. I mean, the best season in their franchise's history with 52 wins, but you know, Lethbridge had the best second half of any team in the league, and you know, so you knew it was going to be a tough series, as you would expect, and to get down to four teams left in the playoffs. But from a Pat standpoint, I mean, got off to a really good start, scored a minute 10 in, and probably for the first 10 minutes, I really dominated the game. I mean, outshot Lethbridge 11-2 at the first media timeout. But after that, just lost, I don't know what it was. It's tough to put the finger on, but for the last 50 minutes of the game, the Pats kind of didn't have whatever it was that worked in that first 10 minutes. I mean, they didn't generate a lot of scoring chances. They kind of sat back, and it was a very different team than we had saw in the last round of the playoffs, and Lethbridge was able to come back and, you know, score an empty netter late and win 3-1. So I think from the coaching staff standpoint, pretty disappointed with how they let a real good start get away and kind of got away from their game plan for sure.
You know, Phil, it's amazing to me how many connections there are between Regina and Manitoba. Maybe not so surprising considering that we're neighbors, but you know, you have John Paddock, general manager and head coach of the Regina Pats, former general manager and head coach of the Winnipeg Jets. You've got Adam Brooks from Winnipeg, drafted by the Toronto Maple Leafs, and Nick Henry from Portage La Prairie, Manitoba, in his first year in the WHL. He's got 10 points in 11 playoff games. Nick Henry's a guy that's projected to go in the second or third round at the 2017 NHL draft. With Adam Brooks specifically, how did you see his game grow this year in his final year playing for Regina in the WHL?
Yeah, you know, I being with this team for as long as I've had the pleasure of watching Adam since a 16-year-old, and even, you know, just after drafting him at 15 in the second round of the Bantam draft, and, you know, it's been a process. I understand you asked about his growth this year, but I think, to be fair, you have to go back 5 years when, you know, he comes in here as a pretty highly touted guy. I mean, he scored good numbers there in Bantam, and then, you know, coming to the Western Hockey League, didn't really get a lot of opportunity in the first couple of years here, but as soon as John Paddock took over 3 years ago, his game took off. I mean, he had 60 points after just 12 and 24 total in his first 2 years, and then jumped to 120 points in 19, and then this year in 66 games, 130 points. So, I mean, he's just an incredibly smart and skilled player that his game has come so far in the last 3 years, and you know, you have to give a lot of credit to the coaching staff here, putting him in some good spots and, you know, developing his game. But, you know, he's an incredible kid, and I think the thing that benefits him the most, like, he's not the flashiest player you'll ever see. I mean, you look back at some of the other 100-plus point guys in this league, you know, you'd think that they had that high skill, and, you know, you notice them every time they're on the ice. Not that you don't notice Adam, but his biggest asset, I think, is the way that he thinks the game. He's very smart and, you know, always finds himself in the right place. He's a hard-working kid that, you know, is going to go in and force turnovers and that type of thing. So, yeah, he's been an incredible player to watch, one of my favorites in my time here, for sure.
Phil, you talked about the best season that Regina's had, 112 points, and I went back and I looked, and for the last 40 years since they've been playing 72 games, this team's been unbelievable. You know, they haven't had a top, I think, an Eastern Division final since 92-93. How much excitement is there in Regina for this team right now?
It's actually unbelievable. Throughout the regular season, it started to build, and you know, people in the city, I think, have waited a long time to have a team where they think has a chance to do something come playoff time. And you know, we just sold out our 21st game last night here at the Brandt Center this year, including the regular season. So that in itself tells you how much people are behind this team. Once the Pats won Game 7 of the second round against Swift Current, tickets went on sale for Games 1 and 2 of this series the next day at noon, and both games were sold out in 9 minutes. So it's almost hard to believe that in our league that people are this fired up about it, especially here in Regina, because it hasn't been this good in so long. But, I mean, the fan support has been just unreal. And the just the atmosphere in the building. I mean, we've seen kind of a shift from, you know, the older generation that just likes to come and sit and watch the game to maybe a more party atmosphere here in the Brandt Center. So it's not just about the hockey sometimes. Like you see in the NHL, I mean, people are there to party and have a good time, and we're seeing that here. So it's been an incredible year that way, too, for sure.
Phil Andrews is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Phil is the Regina Pats play-by-play broadcaster. We're talking about the Western Hockey League's Eastern Conference Championship. It's the Pats and the Lethbridge Hurricanes. Hurricanes taking Game 1. Game 2 goes tonight in Regina. Phil, you know, the Pats had an easy first-round matchup. Well, maybe not easy, but they were able to sweep the Calgary Hitmen in four straight games. Then they had a much more difficult second-round matchup. They were down 3-1 to the Swift Current Broncos before coming back, winning the last three games to overcome that deficit. How much do you think the team has learned in the adversity they faced in that second-round matchup against Swift Current?
I think a lot, too. And you know, everyone around the team, I think, learned something about the team, too, because you know, we've talked about how good their season was. But to go into Game 5 in the second round against Swift Current, and that was really the first time this year that they had to win a game. You know, like, there was never a point where their backs were against the wall at any time. I mean, you know, they were well in the lead in the division, well in the lead in the league at the end. Like, they didn't come to a point where they had to really step up and win a game to win something or to get somewhere. So that was the first time we saw it in round two, and they passed with flying colors. You look at the first four games of that series, and the Pats down 3-1 all three of those games that they lost went in overtime. And so it wasn't that they were playing well in the series, it just they didn't get that bounce or that goal in OT. But you know, for a team that was, you know, had a great year, they didn't, you know, get down on themselves after losing in triple OT in Game 4 to trail the series 3-1, and they just came back and stuck with it and played three incredible games and came back and won the first 3-1 deficit overcome in franchise history. So, yeah, I think that, you know, as a team, they learned a lot that, you know, despite whatever can happen in the playoffs, that they have what it takes to come back and do it. And then the people in and around this team have a lot of confidence in the club based on how they responded to that adversity.
You know, Phil, one of those Manitoba connections that I failed to mention is, I know he's not playing in the series, he's injured, but Jake Lecision, son of Curtis Lecision, obviously from Thompson, Manitoba, played very many years for the Quebec Nordiques and Colorado Avalanche. Phil, we got to ask you about Sam Steele. He's got 19 points in 12 games, first-round pick of the Anaheim Ducks. Is it safe to say that the Anaheim Ducks, who just swept the Calgary Flames there in the first round, is it safe to say that they might have a bit of a steal with Sam Steele?
Yeah, I think so. And it's tough to say you get a steal in the first round, but at 30 overall, they got a hell of a player in Sam Steele. And, you know, and I understand why he didn't go till 30. Based on, you know, his first two seasons in our league, and you know, he had a really good playoff in his draft year, and really maybe the last 20 games of the year was really, really good. But what he's done this year over the summer to come back and have 131 points and lead the entire Canadian Hockey League in scoring, I don't think anybody would have projected that big of a jump from a point-a-game guy. And you know what happens in our league? You get a year older, you get stronger and that type of thing. But Sam, and I know it's cliche when you talk about hockey players, but he's the guy that wants to be a hockey player. You know what I'm saying? Like, there are guys in our league that are happy to be here and you know, work at their craft and are good players. But Sam Steele's the guy that's going to put in more work than anybody else because he wants to be a hockey player. And it's unbelievable to see a guy that, you know, at the end of the year had 131 points and he's staying out after practice for an hour working on all the little things in his game. He's going to be a good pro hockey player. There's no doubt in my mind. And at this level, he's dominant. I mean, playoff time, it's a little bit tougher for him, but at the same time, he's got 19.7 of them goals. He has been, one of the best players I've seen in Regina, no doubt about that. Jordan Weal rivals him now with the Philadelphia Flyers back, 6 years ago now, but an incredibly skilled, smart player, and he's going to have a long career wherever he goes.
Phil, you know, I know we're focused on the present and the playoffs for Regina, but, you know, with the how historic Regina franchise is, getting the 100th celebration of the Memorial Cup next year in Regina, what does that mean for the city and the team?
It's so exciting. I mean, from our standpoint, obviously, it's a match made in heaven, considering it's the 100th anniversary of the Memorial Cup and also the 100th anniversary of the Regina Pats. And the Pats played in the first ever Memorial Cup in Toronto. So, I mean, it just makes sense from a nostalgia standpoint that it would come to Regina. And then you look at the team that we have here and what we project to do next year with, you know, the likes of Sam Steele and Josh Mahura, another Anaheim Ducks prospect, and, you know, the guys that are with this club that they feel that they can challenge for a championship next year as well. So that obviously plays into it when you're a host club. But, I mean, this city is very excited about it. The team is obviously very excited about it. Looking forward to really a year-long celebration of 100 years of junior hockey in Regina and across Canada.
You know, Phil, for fans in Winnipeg or across Manitoba, even if we have listeners right now in Saskatchewan, have tickets gone on sale for the 2018 Memorial Cup yet, or is that going to be announced soon?
Yeah, no, not yet. That'll be something this summer. I think that'll come in conjunction with our season tickets and that type of thing. You kind of have to work with the Canadian Hockey League as to how the packages look and that type of thing. So it's not something we can just put on sale right now, but it will be coming this summer that they start going, but have to wait and see.
Phil Andrews is the Regina Pats play-by-play broadcaster. The Pats and the Lethbridge Hurricanes doing battle in the Western Hockey League's Eastern Conference playoff championship. It's sort of a mouthful to think about the Regina Western Hockey League Eastern Conference. That's something I would change if I was the WHL commissioner for a day. That's something I would look about finding something new to say.
And I think we're thrown off a little bit by the Wheaties getting knocked out in the first round. We're not used to that, right?
That too, of course.
Doesn't happen very often.
Not that often at all. Phil, appreciate your time this morning. Enjoy the rest of the conference championships. It should be a dandy.
Thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate it.
Take care. When we come back, we'll do some postmortems on the Ducks and the Flames and the Penguins and the Blue Jackets. One final segment to come. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Curve Hockey Show returns. Now you're on the curve on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
seconds away as Bieksa looks up and sees the final seconds tick away. He motions to the crowd, and Anaheim has swept the Calgary Flames by virtue of tonight's 3-1 win here in Game 4. Our star of the game, no doubt about it, Brian John Gibson.
The Anaheim Ducks dispatch the Calgary Flames 4-0. The Pittsburgh Penguins, in what I thought was going to be a much closer series, if I am completely truthful, they dispatched the Columbus Blue Jackets 4-1. So the Ducks and the Penguins move on to the second round. The Flames and the Blue Jackets move on to golfing. Pretty sure I've seen that Ducks-Flames series before, guys. Didn't that look a lot like the Jets-Ducks series from a couple years ago?
Including Michael Frolik. It was eerily Uncanny. Reminiscent of the of that 2015 series with the Jets.
Yeah, I the Anaheim Ducks. It was the games were close for the most part, and the Ducks always found a way to pull it off in the end. I mean, the death knell for the Flames was that game 3 where they had the game in hand. They're up 4-2 entering the third period, and they just can't secure the victory. The Ducks come back, they score 2 in the third to tie it up, and then they win it in overtime on Corey Perry's goal. But that was a very reminiscent series of the Jets and the Ducks a couple years back, including going right down to the Ducks having better goaltending. I mean, Brian Elliott probably... Did he cost himself a contract with the Flames, given his play in this series?
Yeah, he might have, Drew. And, you know, you mentioned this reminds you a lot of the series a couple years ago between the Jets and the Ducks, a series in which the Jets were swept, but they held the lead for much of the first 3 games of the series, not so much the 4th game. The Ducks won that handily, but,
right.
You know, 3 of these 4 games were one-goal games. And, you know, I mentioned it a couple of segments ago. This is one of the series I was looking the most forward to, and, you know, unfortunately, it only lasts 4 games, but it was a physical series. I mean, you had the history with Mark Giordano and Cam Fowler, and they were going after Mark Giordano a little bit there. And, you know, let's be honest, one of the big factors in the series was that Johnny Gaudreau was completely shut down. Mm-hmm. And Sean Monahan was great. I thought Sean Monahan was the best forward for the Calgary Flames. But again, I mean, when you're talking about this Ducks team, and we all know who it starts with, Ryan Getzlaf, yeah. Corey Perry, Ryan Kesler. Getzlaf was incredible. I mean, he was the best player in the series for me, maybe with the exception of John Gibson, who outplayed Brian Elliott. And maybe it does cost Brian Elliott some money. But, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, Brian Elliott had an up-and-down regular season. He definitely finished stronger than he started because sure. At the beginning of the season, for parts of the year, Chad Johnson was the number one goalie, right, Drew? So, you know, it was much closer than a series sweep would indicate. But again, I mean, similar to the Oilers-Shark series, it's a veteran team versus a young team, right? Yeah. And, you know, when you talk about Calgary, I mean, guys like, you know, Michael Backlund and Matthew Tkachuk and Michael Frolik, they just weren't factors, right?
It's sort of admirable, and I mean, I don't like Ryan Kesler. I think Corey Perry certainly plays on the edge. It's sort of admirable, though, how those guys and their veteran leadership just sort of choke the life out of any young upstart team. You know, a couple of years back, the Jets were like, oh, they're the young upstart team going up against the Ducks. Maybe they have an opportunity to pull an upset. And this year, same thing. The Flames, they got a lot of young talent. They had some good things going for them. And these Ducks veterans just don't let them, when push comes to shove and they might be close for the first 40 minutes of the game, they know how to get that key goal when they need it. And they know how to just prevent the flicker of an upset from even entering the picture.
Well, it's interesting that to show, like, I remember a few years back, I looked at whether a team had to come into the Stanley Cup playoffs hot to see whether they would, you know, if that would carry them through.
Sure.
The Ducks haven't lost since March 10th. They're 10-0-3 or something like that in their last 13 games, and they've been on fire. I mean, think about it, they haven't lost in regulation mm-hmm. in over a month. And they've just been, and like you said, Drew, it's the veteran players who are playing great. Nate Thompson, recovering from an Achilles heel injury that kept him out for 3 months in the season, had, what do you have, like two goals, two assists. Yeah, in game 3 and 4, he was really good. So, I mean, and like as he talked about, Gibson was excellent in net, and that was the difference. And that was, you know, I mean, again, Calgary tried to generate with their young players. attempting to step up. And look, it's a good learning experience for them. But, I mean, Anaheim was clearly the better team.
Yeah, and, you know, you mentioned the goaltending again, Dave. And, you know, you don't have Cam Fowler for this entire series. And then you don't have Sammy Vatanen for, I believe, the last, was it two or three games?
Two games, I believe.
And you had Brandon Montour step up on that top pairing with Hampus Lindholm. And I really like Brandon Montour's game. He's a guy who spent the majority of the season with San Diego in the American Hockey League, Dave. And then you had Shea Theodore, who had a great series. He was on that second pair with Kevin Bieksa. Or was it Josh Manson? It was either Manson or Bieksa there, and then you had Carbinian Holzer on the third pair. So the Ducks have a lot of depth on defense, right? How many teams can lose Vatanen and Fowler and then have other players that can step up and they don't really skip a beat? And, you know, this Ducks team for many years has been a top defensive team in the league, right? And I think that's what happened against the Calgary Flames. Let's be honest, with the exception of Game 3 where the Flames took it to overtime. Well, I guess we should say the Ducks took it to overtime because the Flames had the lead in that game. I think it was 3-1 at one point.
It was 4-2 entering the third period.
4-2, there you go. And, you know, the Ducks won that game. And I think that was really demoralizing for the Flames, going down 3-0. And, you know,
similar
the series
to the
is
Jets
over.
Similar to the Jets and Ducks series where that game three went to overtime.
Yep.
The Ducks score in overtime. And then the game four, the Ducks, you know, that, manhandled the Jets just like they easily handled the Flames in game four.
The game three... Ducks Flames one though is that controversial Nate Thompson goal, which was appeared to be a high stick, and it counted and kind of brought the momentum back, and then again got Anaheim back in the game.
Well, you know, as they say, the Ducks know how to get it done come playoff time. And certainly against these young teams, they were very impressive in this series. They're going to meet the winner of the Sharks and the Oilers, but they're a team that certainly needed some time off to get healthy, especially on the back end, and they've had that time off. This series likely won't start till Wednesday or so, which means you're going to have almost a full week off for the Anaheim Ducks.
Yeah, Drew, and similar to the Blues Wild series where I mentioned that I thought that the Blues were a bad matchup for the Wild, I don't think you could have had a worse matchup for the Calgary Flames. And it's not just because the Calgary Flames can't win at Honda Center. They haven't won at Honda Center in 10 years. It's just the Ducks play a very similar style to the Flames, I think. The Flames are a fast team, but the Ducks are also a fast team. But the Ducks are one of those last remaining teams that plays that heavy style, right? Getzlaff, Kessler, Perry, these guys, even a guy like Patrick Eves, who is a great trade deadline acquisition. These guys wear you down. And they can score timely goals, right? So I agree with what you guys are saying. Even though the scores were close, you had a lot of one-goal games in this short series. I mean, the Ducks were just too much veteran experience, I think, for the Flames to handle. The Flames, though, get back into the playoffs, and the future is definitely promising. But again, like the Jets found out 2 years ago, the Ducks are one of those measuring stick teams, right? They've done it so many times. They haven't won a cup in 10 years, but they're always there in the playoffs. They always seem to manage to get to at least the second round, and the Flames just didn't have a response for them.
Quickly on the Penguins and the Blue Jackets, the Penguins dispatch the Blue Jackets in 5 games. I think the series can be summed up as follows. Sergei Bobrovsky, .882 save percentage, 3.88 goals against average. If the Blue Jackets were going to win that series, he needed to be their best player, and he wasn't. It was a very disappointing playoffs for Sergei Bobrovsky.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're going up against the top offense in the NHL, right, Drew? But he wasn't good. I mean, Marc-Andre Fleury flat out outplayed Sergei Bobrovsky, and you just mentioned his numbers. They weren't good. Mm-hmm. So you weren't expecting really Sergei Bobrovsky necessarily to allow that many goals. But again, I'm not that surprised, because when you have Malkin and Crosby and Kessel and, you know, Jake Guentzel has had a great rookie year. He scored a hat trick in the series. So not that surprised. I had the Penguins winning the series in 6. Definitely, you know, thought it might go one or two more games. But yeah, Bobrovsky wasn't good.
That's it for this Saturday morning here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, and Keener Jerseys. Support these fine Winnipeg businesses because they support the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Big props to producer Rory, doing a great job behind the board. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com. That's where you can also find this show in case you missed any of it. It's available for download on our website and, of course, on iTunes. For my colleagues Dave Minuk and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290.
As long as we stick together, the team will be all right.